Call the first case, please. You may proceed.
May it please this honorable court. My name is Attorney Carl C. Lamondu from Norfolk, Virginia. And if it pleases this honorable court, Chief Justice, justices of this court, this is a wrongful death action brought against two former Norfolk police officers who, in response to a non-emergency domestic disturbance call, without any specific knowledge of the nature or circumstances of the call, and in violation of mandatory Norfolk police operating procedures, recklessly sped across a pedestrian bridge without emergency lights or sirens activated and caused the death of a cyclist. The plaintiff mother initially filed a cause of action against the officers alleging gross negligence. The case was set for trial, and after written discovery and depositions, the defendants moved for summary judgment, which was denied by the court. Both parties then filed numerous motions in limine, of which the court ruled upon, and the case was ready to be tried on the set date. Approximately 1 week prior to that trial, one of the defendants moved for a continuance, of which the court granted, and a new court date was set approximately 8 months from the first trial date. The court then granted defendant's motion over plaintiff's objection that all further discovery be frozen at that time. The plaintiff then moved for a leave to amend her complaint by agreement to allege simple negligence as a sole cause of action, understanding that the facts would not change as discovery was frozen and the court had previously denied the defendant's motion for summary judgment. The defendants then filed a special plea of sovereign governmental immunity. The trial court heard the special plea, and contrary to Virginia law, under Friday Spivey v. Collier, Muse v. Sliding, Hyder v. Clemens, Colby v. Borden, and other Virginia Supreme Court law, determined that the defendants were entitled to sovereign immunity protection and granted the defendant's special plea. What was of note in the hearing on the special plea was that for the first time, after the defendants gave statements to internal affairs, to the homicide investigator, and in depositions, all indicating that there were no appropriate reasons to speed across the pedestrian bridge, at the hearing, they manufactured the claim that the location of the domestic disturbance call was in a dangerous area of the city, and the call may or may not be more serious than they were aware. This excuse, nevertheless, does not provide a basis for an exigent circumstance under Virginia case law.
Counsel?
Yes, sir.
Did they indicate at all how one defines a dangerous area of the city?
No, sir. They gave no objective basis for the court to consider whether or not this was a dangerous area of the city. Virginia case law.
Am I correct that the court never ruled on your initial gross negligence claim, that you simply dropped it out of the case? Am I correct about that?
That is correct, Judge. They ruled on the summary judgment motion, which basically affirmed that claim to go before go for trial.
And then, then when you amended your complaint, you chose to leave out gross negligence.
That was correct. And the reason was that the facts in this case were so blatantly and plainly clear that the officers could not avail themselves of sovereign immunity, that in the time frame, the eight-month time frame, that the court would have to be able to resolve that, we were certainly confident that this did not comport with Virginia case law, Your Honor.
Would have been nice to have a backup.
It would have. Virginia case law involving sovereign immunity of municipal employees has long determined that the exercise of normal, everyday discretion within the realm of normal driving conditions does not confer sovereign immunity. Sovereign immunity requires that there exist an exigent circumstance of which the defendants were performing a discretionary act at the time of the incident and not simply a ministerial act, i.e., driving on their way to answer a non-emergency domestic disturbance call.
And when you rely on this court's opinion in the Friday Spivey case, which involved a fire truck.
Yes, sir.
And a dispatcher's categorization of a call. But unlike Friday Spivey, in this case, there are actual police policies that allow an officer to adjust their response based upon knowledge that they might independently have. So doesn't that distinguish Friday Spivey from the fire truck case, from this case, rather?
Judge, we don't believe it does. We don't feel it does. It's in line with Friday and Spivey.
Your whole case is based on the idea that the police officers had a code 3, non-emergency code, given to them from the dispatcher, and that the police officers cannot vary from the dispatcher's characterization of the call.
Excuse me. That is correct, Your Honor.
But there's a policy in the police department that says different.
If the police officers had specific knowledge, and that's where the Muse, Friday, the Spivey case, the height, there are other cases in line, particularly where there has to be some exigent circumstance. The police officer just can't manufacture some excuse
As between a dispatcher and a police officer on the street, which one of the two of those people is more likely to be aware of the circumstances in a particular neighborhood?
Well, it depends. I would certainly think the dispatch would be more aware at that particular time of those circumstances. Why a dispatcher is receiving phone calls on a constant basis.
But the police officers are in the neighborhood on a constant basis. Wouldn't that be a better source of information?
If there were some verifiable, objective reasons or facts that a police officer would know that in this particular neighborhood, on this particular evening, we're talking about specific circumstances.
Well, but we do have some general circumstances. We know that a domestic relations disturbance is one of the most dangerous calls that a police officer ever responds to.
That's not necessarily true. That's.
I tell you what, interview police officers, you'll find it's true. It's something that puts them all on edge because you have emotions that are high, and then a police officer enters, and they're at peril. Some neighborhoods are more difficult than others, and even our reasonable, articulable suspicion jurisprudence recognizes that. So you have police officers who know the area, who get a domestic disturbance call, and you're suggesting that even with the police policy, that a dispatcher sitting in an office somewhere has a better understanding of the circumstances than officers who are on the street.
Certainly, I would suggest that they do, because they're the ones who initially receive the call. They can determine whether a call is a person wielding a knife, which they would relay to the police officer, or if it's a general domestic disturbance, someone just not agreeing with another at the home. And if you follow that line of reasoning, Your Honor, then the officers would have blanket or absolute immunity anytime a domestic disturbance or an uncoded call is called their way. They could just go willy-nilly and do whatever they want and then claim sovereign immunity and be totally immune. So there has to be some distinction.
Which is the reason why I asked you why you left out gross negligence, but that's another matter altogether.
Yes, sir.
Go ahead with your argument.
Yes, sir. The defendants in this case confirmed in their own words that there was no accident or emergency situation, and they proceeded without any specific knowledge about the particular call at high rates of speed in violation of the posted speed limits without activating the emergency lights or siren, in violation of the Norfolk Police Department operating procedures for mandatory Code 3 response, which required that emergency lights and or siren will not be used, all posted signs and traffic laws will be observed, and when no specific response code is assigned to the message, the response code 3 will be used. And these are mandatory directions by the Norfolk Police Department. The trial court erroneously misinterpreted the Muse case, which is a federal Fourth Circuit case that not only applied Virginia case law, but cites and heavily relied upon the then-recent Friday Spivey case, and focused on the argument, which was advanced by the argument of the defendants, that because the defendants made some discretionary decisions, sovereign immunity was appropriate, instead of properly focusing on the lack of any emergency or exigent circumstances. The plan continually...
You seem to be getting your standards mixed up in this argument. I just want to make sure I know what it is. Are you saying that under no circumstances does a police officer have a discretion to respond in anything other than a Code 3 non-emergency call? Or are you saying that they can, but they have to have very specific knowledge of something that would allow them to respond differently? Which one is your standard?
Your, the standard, pursuant to the Norfolk Police Department policies, is that all uncoded calls shall be, which is a mandatory language, be responded to as a Code 3 response.
Now, I'm asking you, does a police officer have any discretion to vary from those terms? And I've heard you say on one occasion they have no discretion whatsoever, and I've heard you say in response to some of my questions that they do, but it has to be related to specific information they have about this call. I'm just trying to figure out which one is your standard that you're arguing here today.
Yes, sir. The standard would be that they do not have discretion for an uncoded call, a Code 3 call. However, however, if there is specific information Virginia case law, as interpreted by the Muse case, would allow them to proceed without liability, and there is no specific
circumstance. I don't understand that response. That's exactly what I'm trying to get at. You started out by saying they have no discretion at all,
sir.
then you back into, well, if they have some information, maybe they do have discretion. Which one is it?
Your Honor, I would assert that they do not have discretion under the procedures and operating policies of the Norfolk Police Department unless it has no discretion to deviate unless there is they have some specific knowledge of some exigent circumstance.
All right.
So in other words, Muse has created an exception to the Norfolk policy. Would that be the way to express it?
Well, I believe that would be the way Muse would have interpreted the circumstances in that particular case. And of course, in the Muse case, the officer received a non-emergency call initially, but the dispatch informed the officer that there was a 14-year-old wielding a knife who had attacked her father, and this was currently ongoing. And so the court reasoned that that this was a situation where the officer had specific knowledge of an exigent circumstance, which would prevent the officer from being civilly liable for running into another vehicle on the way to answer this circumstance. But other than the officer knowing that there was an exigent circumstance, not just some subjecture or conjecture or some speculation of well, this is a bad neighborhood of the city, or this is a tough. The officer had specific knowledge that there was an exigent circumstance, and that's why the court, in following Friday and Spivey, did not hold the officer liable for running into the vehicle. Yes, sir. A trial court in misapplying the Muse case determined that the question of immunity turns on whether the situation presents a genuine need for judgment and discretion on the part of the emergency responder, but failed to articulate any facts or circumstances that supported this contention. The trial court stated in its opinion letter The appropriate question is whether the officer exercised discretion at all. And this is that blanket discretion that the trial court in this particular case just gave to the police officers. And if this court were to affirm the trial court's decision, it would give blanket immunity to all police officers regarding whatever they were doing or whatever they knew or did not know about any particular situation at all. The trial court, in contravention of this court's controlling decisions, concluded that the exercise of any type of discretion whatsoever provided the defendants with blanket immunity. Respectfully, Your Honors, my time is up.
All right. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
May it please the court, I'm Alan Rashkin. I'm appearing on behalf of one of the two defendants below Bennett. Mr. Casey, seated next, well, where I was seated next to me, will be speaking on behalf of the other officer, Falston, and it is our plan to divide the time equally. Before I begin to address some of the questions that the court addressed, I just want to point out something that I don't think has been addressed on any briefs, and I'll take as much blame for that as anyone. We talk about this court's jurisprudence, and there's much of it. You might ask, well, what has the General Assembly said about sovereign immunity? I go back to Colby versus Boynton, decided 23 years, less 1 month ago. And in that case, this court said, if sovereign immunity is to be abrogated, and that, of course, was a police case, that should be done explicitly rather than implicitly by the General Assembly, there being an argument between the majority and the dissenting justices as to whether or not a statute effectively abrogated sovereign immunity. What has the General Assembly done in the 23 years since that decision to narrow in any respect sovereign immunity for police officers or first responders? Nothing. What have they done, however? In 1997, they amended the uninsured motorist statute, 38.2.2206, in order to add a section to the definition of uninsured motorist, making either defendants who are granted immunity under federal or state law uninsured motorists, thereby allowing a remedy where none might have existed because of sovereign immunity. To me, that says the General Assembly is not complaining about what this court has done with sovereign immunity. Yes,
Counsel,
sir.
You mentioned Colby. Let's go directly to Colby.
Yes, sir.
Quoting from Colby, unlike the driver in routine traffic, the officer must make difficult judgments about the best means of effectuating the governmental purpose by embracing special risks in an emergency situation. Such situations involve necessarily discretionary, split-second decisions balancing grave personal risks. You agree with that statement, do you not?
Of course.
As do I. Counsel, that was in a pursuit case.
Yes, sir.
If we were to adopt that statement in this case, we would be expanding Colby, would we not?
I don't think we would. I respectfully submit.
Okay. So tell me then, if indeed that is your position, I expected that would be the case, what emergency situation were these officers facing?
They were facing a situation where they had to respond rapidly because of their, and I'll get to the familiarity of the area after I answer your question. They found they had to balance the need to respond quickly for this domestic disturbance with the obstacles on the road, and they had to weigh and calculate the matrix of 10 factors that the general order required.
Indeed. Let's stop right there.
Yes, sir.
I'm looking at page 34 of the joint appendix. That is the guidance for emergency operation.
I
correct?
Also, yes, sir.
And it is mandatory.
Yes, sir.
Okay. In order to get to the 10 factors, they've got to meet one of the four predicate factors.
I agree.
Which of those predicate factors were they dealing with?
Number one.
When the immediate presence of the police is required in order to protect a person from possible death or serious injury, what in this particular circumstance caused them to believe that there was possible death or serious injury?
Because of their experience, and you asked the question, what factors did the officers have in mind that allowed them?
Was it their experience with domestic calls or their experience with this neighborhood or both?
Both. And the officers testified that they had both been assigned to this sector for the entirety of their career.
Okay. And counsel, why then does the Norfolk Police Department code domestic disturbances in that neighborhood as a code 3?
I would submit that these officers know better than the dispatcher knew.
Okay, I'm not asking. Okay, is the dispatcher the only person who decides whether it will be code 3 no matter where it is? Is that a unilateral decision on the part of the dispatcher with no guidance from anyone else?
As far as I know, that is correct. Now, there was no evidence in the record on that, but as far as I know, it's also my understanding that the dispatchers are civilian employees of the city of Norfolk.
Is that on the record?
That is not in the record either.
Okay. Now, the nature of the call itself is what causes it. So, in other words, they will always respond in this fashion to a domestic disturbance in this dangerous neighborhood.
In this neighborhood, at that time of day, on a weekend morning, based upon their testimony, and for instance, I point to...
How do you define a dangerous neighborhood?
Their experience was, and this is at pages 511 to 512 of the appendix, the testimony of Bennett at the hearing on the special plea before Judge Jones, in which he explained that their experience was that in this neighborhood, a domestic disturbance is frequently underreported, and when they arrive, they find a much more dangerous situation.
Are there any statistics in the record that would bear that out?
There are none, but the trial judge listened carefully.
So it's entirely their subjective determination?
I don't believe that's subjective. I think it's their testimony about their objective observations. Now, it may be that there could have been others who would have testified to the contrary, but no one did. Their testimony at that point was uncontradicted, and I submit it's accepted by the trial judge, and on that issue, it's like a jury verdict.
Okay, let's split apart the two aspects of emergency operation. What was it in particular that required them to go faster than the speed limit? What were the factors that caused them to say, because of these factors, we must go faster than the speed limit?
Their concern that people were in danger as a result of their experience with calls at this time of night on the weekend in that neighborhood.
Okay. What were the facts? Okay, so no specific factors in this case. It was all based upon prior experience.
That and the fact that it was a domestic disturbance call, which requires, under Norfolk Police guidelines, that there be backup. And also, Officer Folston testified that he heard words to the effect that there was an unruly male. He said the word unruly wasn't
Where did
used.
He hear that?
Where did he hear that during the dispatch? That was the testimony of Folston.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'll
I can find it.
Okay.
It is
not to worry.
Page 563 of the appendix.
Now, what specific factors were present to cause them to not use their lights and not use a siren?
They testified that they thought it was likely that they would be doing more harm than good, in that they would be disturbing people in the area they were going through on their way to Tidewater Gardens. And Officer Falston testified that there are examples where using your lights and sirens, at least when you get closer to the area in question, can alert and alarm the person you're trying to apprehend.
Let me actually split it into two. Precisely, based upon that answer, precisely who might they have been disturbing on the Campostella Bridge?
I don't know that there would have been anybody on the Campostella Bridge.
So there's no specific reason for not using your lights and your siren or both when you're on the Campostella Bridge.
No, there is a reason not to use it, and that's because of the little or no traffic.
There was definitely some traffic.
Not on Campostella
Bridge. There was
Bridge.
A bike.
That bike was not on the Campostella Bridge.
I understand.
Understood.
Mr. Raskin, may I ask you a question about all that? I've heard what you said, and from my questions to opposing counsel, you probably could discern that I have some idea that officers ought to have discretion. But in this case, on page 23 of the transcript, there is a question asked of Officer Bennett, and the question is, what was the reason, if you were going 60, if that's what you thought, what was the reason? And he gets an answer from the officer before he gets to finish the question. And the answer is, there was no excuse or reason for going that speed. It was just I was driving, and I guess I wasn't really looking at the speedometer. Were you paying attention to how fast you were going at the time? No, I was just kind of cruising up. Now, with that in the record, how can you rely on all of the things that you've just told us about when the officer himself says there wasn't any reason for us to go 60 miles an hour?
I can answer that question in two ways. The first way is the officer, I believe, when you read that interview by his superior officer, is testifying to why he was going that fast as he was going up to and on the top of Campo Stella Bridge. This accident happened after he'd gotten over, come down, and then it happened. However,
well,
it is
more recent because it's very close to where this man was killed.
It's actually on the other side of the bridge. I would argue with you that it's not close, but I do recognize that it's certainly on the path to the place where the accident happened. But I want to address your suggestion that it's part of the record. While it's part of the record in this case, it is not part of the record that was before the trial court when the special plea was heard. That statement was not offered as contradiction to what the officer had said. He was not cross-examined on that. There was no attempt made to do that. That was an attachment to a box of exhibits. We've got a banker's box of exhibits that were filed pre-trial in October, and this was a statement taken shortly after the accident with no attention. There was no addressing the sovereign immunity because that was a police interview shortly after the accident. I hope I've answered those questions, and I've left only 4 minutes and some for Mr. Casey, to whom I will now yield. Thank you.
Thank you.
The Norfolk Police Department issued the general order regarding discretion, which has been discussed a little bit this morning. By the way, I'm Brian Casey. I represent Derek Olson in this matter. And in that general order, the general order gives the officers discretion to operate their vehicles in emergency situations when the immediate presence of the police is required in order to protect a person from possible death or serious injury. And the officers testified in this particular case that their experience in Tidewater Gardens for domestic disturbance calls was that the situation, that there were the worst shootings, the worst beatings, stabbings, bleeding outs, and that they were always, when they responded to such calls in Tidewater Gardens, they always had those types of situations. It could be anything to the worst imaginable.
Counsel, I don't think there's any dispute that it's a dangerous area.
So then
the primary question, in my mind, relates to the speed and the lights.
Right. So then when my client, Officer Folston, decides, he exercises his own discretion to put himself on a call as a backup, because the Norfolk Police Department requires that officers responding to the domestic disturbance calls have backups because of the dangerous situation. He knows he's not assigned as the backup in this particular case, but he takes it upon himself, using his judgment and discretion as a police officer, which the order suggests that he should do, and decides to become the backup to Officer Bennett to protect Officer Bennett's safety. So then he has to decide, once he becomes the backup to Officer Bennett, how's he going to respond? How's he going to be that backup? Officer Bennett is driving across the Campo Stella Bridge at a speed that's exceeding the speed limit without lights and sirens on. Officer Folston chooses to fall in right behind him, keep up with him at the same speed in order to arrive at the scene of the potentially dangerous and life-threatening or serious injury call at the same time that Officer Bennett arrives, so that he can be an effective backup, because the department says that there has to be a backup there. So he's exercising discretion in the manner in which he's operating his vehicle in order to be that backup to that officer. And he testified in at the hearing that he understood from the general order that he was given that discretion to operate his vehicle in that manner without lights and siren and exceeding the speed limit. He testified why he didn't use lights and siren, because there wasn't anybody on the Campo Stella Bridge at 1 o'clock in the morning that he needed to alert as to his presence on the bridge with his lights and siren, other than Officer Bennett. He didn't need to alert him. And that that in his experience, when they roll up on a scene with their sirens going, they scare the people away, the bad guys that they may want to encounter. And so he chose not to do it.
Does a domestic disturbance necessarily involve bad guys?
It may, it may not. It doesn't necessarily involve bad guys. But it in the experience of the officers, and that's in the record, it often
if you are responding to a violent act out on the street, gunshots. If you're responding to a potentially a drug transaction, you think bad guys, and you also think fleeing. I've never thought of a domestic disturbance in the same light.
Well, the record that was testified, the testimony by Officer Folsom was that was the reason that he didn't operate his siren at the time of this at the time he was responding as backup to Bennett, because he, in his experience, when the sirens are operated, it often results in people scattering, leaving the scene, and people, suspects or perpetrators, I can't remember the exact term that he used. And that was the reason that he gave in the record. It was uncontradicted as to why he chose not to use his lights and the discretion. My time is up. Thank you.
Thank you. Call the next case, please.